don't frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on March 3rd, 2019, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Kelly comes back on the show to talk to me and Nate about Elliot Abrams' return to power and the U.S.-backed genocides in Central America in the 1980s. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio again this week is Nate. Hi, Nate. Welcome back.
Hey, Bill.
And joining us on the line from Washington, D.C., after a couple years off the show, our former co-host on the show, Kelly. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me today.
So we are going to be talking primarily about Central America this half hour. For those who don't remember, Kelly was in the Peace Corps in Central America after she and I were out of college. So we wanted to have her on to give some insights to this particular topic. The reason that Central America stuff is coming back up in the news is, besides some of the things that are actually happening in Central America, is twofold. One, we had that thing in the fall about the so-called caravan, where you had migrants that were trying to escape the terrible conditions in Central America created by the U.S. policies enacted there in the 1980s that still continue to reverberate, as well as more recent U.S. policies that have damaged those countries. And then also the fact that one of the chief architects of the policies in the 1980s, Elliot Abrams, has been recalled to active government service after a number of years out of power while the Democrats were in office. He had also been brought back by the George W. Bush administration previously. This is a guy who was convicted for lying to Congress as part of the Iran-Contra scandal, which the Contra half of that was a Central America policy thing in the 80s, and we can talk about that. He's been recalled this time to organize a coup d'etat by the U.S. government in Venezuela. It's pretty transparent that that's what is happening. Without getting too far into depth about the internals of Venezuela, and various challenges that are going on there, certainly I think we can agree, the three of us, that U.S. policy is certainly not going to help the situation in Venezuela and can only make things worse, especially when it's being run by Elliot Death Squad's Abrams. And it is important to talk about who Elliot Abrams was and is, because, he's been put back in this position of doing quote unquote humanitarian aid and other things like that to Venezuela, mirroring the exact same policies where he was smuggling arms into right-wing death squads in Central America in the 1980s as part of humanitarian packages. And these death squads ended up being responsible in most of these countries for over 90% of the atrocities committed during the quote-unquote civil wars that were generally happening, which were usually pretty one-sided. It was usually the capital and moneyed interests backed by the U.S., supporting these violent reactions against sort of the people that were trying to do basic land reform and social democracy in many cases in Central America. So with that sort of context in mind, let's get into that a bit. Kelly, you have been on the show previously to talk about the genocide that was specifically committed in Guatemala, because that was something that you were familiar with. And that is something that continues to have that reverberating impact to this day. Could you tell us a little bit about what happened in the 1980s in Guatemala?
Sure. So I think the one thing that I would like to say first is just how 1980s might sound like a while ago, but how real this is for Guatemalans, and how, as we see Guatemalans even protesting currently some of the things we'll talk about later on, they're carrying the names of these family members. So these genocides are historical to us, but still very present in the way that Guatemalans operate and think about their government and the United States. And essentially, Guatemala faced similar decade in the 80s as many of their Central American neighbors, and the United States, under the guise of, you know, the Cold War and being nervous about communism, propped up a dictator in Rios Montt, who was eventually convicted of a number of war crimes, and he essentially committed genocide against the indigenous people of Guatemala, largely in the northern and western regions of the country. Really brutal, brutal as can be genocide. And so there's a lot of distrust between the indigenous people and the non-indigenous people in Guatemala that persists. And without getting too historical, I guess, in my analysis, I think the things that persist today is that there was a dictator that was, you know, propped up by the American government. The American government, in my opinion, had to know about the genocide that was happening, but thought that that was better than the socialist, perhaps communist government that could have been. And the American government supplied him with training and weapons and cover on the international stage.
Yeah, in fact, Elliot Abrams specifically said in the 1980s that Rios Montt was a great example of a reformer who was turning things around, especially on the Indian issue.
Wow.
So I guess, you know, I don't know what baseline they were comparing to, but turning things around on the Indian issue by, I guess, wiping them out.
Well, yeah, I mean, in his parlance, I would guess he would say that the problem with the Indians was that they didn't want to go along with things. So if they're dead, then you no longer have that issue.
Yeah. And I read some interesting analysis about how Abrams was in large part responsible for co-opting the term human rights, and sort of saying that communism was a violation of human rights. So anything that happened to stop communism was fine because it was better than communism, including the complete destruction of the indigenous population in Guatemala.
Right. And he is, as you say, he's a humanitarian envoy, so-called, to the situation in Venezuela. I mean, which, again, is a complete joke. Venezuela obviously has some problems, but in the absence of sanctions and whatever, they would be doing better. And it's up to the Venezuelan people to sort out their own internal affairs. It certainly is not going to be helped by the humanitarian affairs guy. But also in the 1980s, as you say, he redefined that term. His specific purview at the State Department was human rights, I think, was the specific title that he had.
Yeah, I guess the other one thing that I would say is that this was all part of a 26-year-long civil war in Guatemala. And it's easy to say in a war that, you know, bad things happen on both sides, and that's what war is about. But a 1999 UN report found that of the crimes committed, 90% of them were the fault of the military, which was being overseen by Rios Montt or one of his predecessors. So to say that it's just a war and this is what happens in war is not an accurate reflection of the crimes committed in Guatemala.
Now, you alluded to just a few minutes ago that in Guatemala right now, present day, this stuff that happened in the 1980s is coming up again in a very current context regarding protests involving some legislation that, I guess, mirroring U.S. practice, is aiming to basically try to sweep it all under the rug and say, let's move on.
I don't know if Nate wants to jump in here, but that is my understanding, is that not only do the indigenous population of does the indigenous population of Guatemala continue to feel in many ways persecuted by their own government, but the government continues to be largely run by people who are not indigenous and have ties one way or the other to these atrocities that were committed. So it is certainly in their interest to, you know, try to forgive and forget and move on. But I'm not sure that's a reflection of what should happen or what the majority of the Guatemalan people would want.
Nate, did you want to talk about that legislation?
Yeah, I mean, this is just something that I saw recently, you know, after all of the kerfuffle surrounding Elliot Abrams and everything there. But, you know, looking into this, it does seem like this has actually been a relatively common practice, and there have been attempts at similar bills that would grant amnesty. I believe there was an attempt in Peru, and there have been attempts in several other countries, although the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights has basically avoided those and said that this proposed amnesty bill in Guatemala would not be legal. But at the same time, they're the ones controlling the judicial system, and if they start not prosecuting people, that could be a serious issue. So the bill would mandate the release within 24 hours of dozens of officials and military officers convicted of crimes related to a 36-year armed conflict, and it would basically halt ongoing or new investigations into human rights violations connected to the Civil War. And so, basically, and you probably know more about this, but there was the Truth and Reconciliation Commission set up in 1999, and that's led to, of course, the Rios Mott prosecutions and various other prosecutions against military officials, including some who I saw that were recently suspected in the connection of the death or the assassination of a bishop, Roman Catholic Bishop Juan Jose Girardi, who was beaten to death shortly after he oversaw the creation of a human rights office for Guatemala. And there was a historical memory project that came out that he oversaw that implicated a lot of these military officials, and 2 days later, he was beaten to death. So we're seeing all sorts of these sort of ramifications coming out through here.
Nate, could you talk a little bit about the El Salvador situation that happened, you know, as Elliot Abrams was coming on to the job in the early 1980s? This is obviously, I think some people are a little bit more familiar with, like, Oscar Romero, another assassinated church figure, and that happened in El Salvador. There were, of course, you know, as Kelly was alluding to, you know, a sort of extended conflict and turmoil surrounding reform happening in, you know, Guatemala and Honduras and El Salvador and Nicaragua. It was not just in one country, but the El Salvador situation is another particularly sort of ghastly mark against Abrams.
Right. Well, the massacre at El Mazote is perhaps the most famous or infamous, and there are people, I believe, on trial right now connected with that massacre and various military officials who knew about it. And, of course, the United States knew about it and tried to cover it up after it was reported out, basically said this is a conspiracy theory. This is fake news. This is just, and they got like New York Times and Washington Post or Wall Street Journal, like reporters transferred off the beat. So they couldn't report on it anymore. And
didn't they try to get them to retract the stories as well?
Yeah, so they did do that and got Raymond Bonner sent back to Washington or whatever. So, you know, they've and of course, Elliot Abrams was involved in all of this as well. And, you know, whether you're talking about El Mazote, or you're talking about, you know, like things like Battalion 316 in Honduras, all of these various just some of the most brutal torture, rape, you know, use of animals, things like that. They're all part of a, you know, a program, whether through Operation Condor, whether through School of the Americas, stretching all the way down through Central and Latin America. You know, we've been talking about Brazil, you know, Argentina, Chile, everywhere.
Yeah, the massacre at El Mazote. I see Nate's got a book here. Who's the author on that?
Mark Danner.
Mark Danner. So yeah, that was a particularly egregious case. I think is that one several hundred or quite a few hundred.
Something
people
like 500,
700.
There's a lot of detail that came from a woman who basically like hid under a tree and was like just covered in dirt and somehow managed to survive, and just some of the most brutal things you can imagine.
Yeah, and these death squads were, again, operating all over Central America. In, you know, if they were in oftentimes they were affiliated with the security forces, whether it was the police or the National Guard or whatever. Generally, they were being given arms shipments through, again, these disguised humanitarian aid shipments coming through Panama. The Panamanian government was supported very closely by the United States up until we suddenly took him out. But he was, you know, this drug cartel operation or whatever that was also helping the U.S. to funnel all these weapons in. And of course, we know, you know, Iran-Contra, I guess, has been sort of also swept under the rug to a large extent. But, you know, people like Elliot Abrams were closely involved with that. Obviously, Oliver North also famously involved in that. And that, you know, involved the Reagan administration actually selling weapons, you know, to the Iranians to get money to give to the Contras, because Congress had said that they couldn't keep funding the Contra paramilitaries in Nicaragua, you know, and so on and so forth. I mean, this was just going on and on throughout the 1980s. And, you know, to some extent, you can say because of some of the suppression stuff that people like Elliot Abrams did of, you know, manipulating the U.S. media, you know, as Nate said, getting people transferred off the beats, getting the newspapers to retract the stories. To some extent, you could say, well, maybe some Americans don't know that this happened because it was kind of hard to tell what was going on. And, you know, maybe they're only, you know, just hearing about it now or something. But realistically, I think especially in Catholic churches, I think, you know, certainly in the Northeast, in the United States, there were a lot of folks who were coming from those countries, especially in the 90s, not long after it had happened, who were telling those stories. And with those high profile assassinations like Oscar Romero, you know, that was famous. And he's now been given sainthood in the Catholic Church. But these were famous things. And you had those early TPS protectee recipients coming from some of these countries in the 90s. You had just generally people, those first waves of people fleeing the situation in these countries, telling their stories. It was very clear that this happened, and there were plenty of people that knew this was happening. So the one thing that I'm wondering is what do you guys make of this reaction that we saw with the Elliot Abrams testimony at Congress, where you know, a bunch of people from like our perspective, especially younger people, were saying, hey, you know, this guy didn't just lie to Congress. He also oversaw and covered up for all these death squads and dictators, you know, and basically was doing war crimes through these groups. And a bunch of, you know, the foreign policy blob just immediately rallying around him and saying, well, he's a very nice guy and he's great to work with and you can't call him a war criminal and how dare you? And then even to the point of saying that these things didn't happen, these war crimes, these massacres, these mass graves and so on, that it just never happened. Kelly, I guess I'll go to you first because you have sort of the most proximate interaction with people that, you know, survived this genocide. What do you make of this reaction where people are just kind of asserting that, oh, this never happened and he had nothing to do with it if it did happen?
Well, I think it's extremely disturbing, obviously. I'm sure we can all just agree on that. And I actually had sort of planned to come here and make a point about how in this administration, there's just like a lot of second chances for people who don't deserve second chances. But as I was reading up on Elliot Abrams, he also, I mean, he was pardoned by George H.W. Bush, who was again appointed by George W. Bush, and again, obviously under the Trump administration. So I am disturbed by this appointment, and I think it's a positive thing that so many young people in particular are also disturbed by this appointment and willing to learn the history, because the history is undisputed by the UN, by the people of Guatemala. So I think it's an important thing just to talk about it. But unfortunately, I don't think it's a new phenomenon that people involved in these sorts of things under the guise of patriotism or national security are excused time and time again. And not only excused, but allowed to continue to sort of propagate their ideas. It was interesting to me that one of Abrams' previous tactics had been to smuggle arms in aid packages, and it's no, you don't fault Venezuela now for not wanting aid packages to arrive in their country. And we hear about it in American media largely as, oh, there's not enough to eat, there's no medicine. But we've also, as a country, smuggled arms that way. And if we continue to appoint people who have done that in the past, then we will certainly continue to do that sort of thing in the future.
Yeah. And I mean, the Venezuelan government also, I think, has been, you know, accepting in aid from countries that they do get along with. I mean, it reminds me a little bit on a sort of microcosmic scale of this, you know, the way that the Cuban embargo always gets talked about in the United States, as if every other country in the world is participating in this embargo, when in fact very few countries are participating in the embargo. They're always like, you know, oh, the Cubans, they're so far behind, and they, you know, they're totally cut off by this U.S. embargo. And it's like, I mean, no one else is following this. Most of Europe trades with Cuba. But in this case, it's the U.S. media say, oh, they won't let in this humanitarian aid from the United States, and for some reason, Richard Branson. And, you know, it's at the border, and it's like, well, okay. I mean, but there's no reason to for the government to think that this isn't some sort of a ploy. I mean, at minimum, even if there isn't a weapons shipment or something for this acting president guy that a bunch of Americans arbitrarily declared to be the acting president, which is bewildering. You know, he's not like the constitutional next in line or even close to the next in line. But, you know, even if there's no arms in these shipments, I think it's, you got to look at that and say, well, at minimum, they're trying to like embarrass the Venezuelan government and like create this sort of perceived standoff. Kelly, I was wondering what you thought about just the sort of irony, isn't maybe the right word, but whatever you want to call it, for the fact that, you know, the Trump last fall and the Trump administration was all keyed up about this so-called migrant caravan of all these people fleeing places like Guatemala and these other Central American countries. And they're effectively attempting to engineer the same thing in a much, much larger country, in the case of Venezuela. I mean, if Venezuela were to completely collapse into what we saw in Central America, I think the numbers of people attempting to come to the United States would be way larger than what we've seen from Central America.
Yeah, I mean, any smart conversation about immigration includes conversations about the push and the pull factors. So what's pushing people out of the place where they currently are, what's pulling people into places like the United States? And there seems to be, in my opinion, a really darn bad job of addressing the pull factors in the United States, but almost no conversation, at least publicly, about those push factors. And you would imagine that, you know, collapsing governments would certainly be a push factor. And we obviously, as a country, aren't willing and able to handle refugees or immigrants or undocumented minors in any sort of compassionate, responsible way. So it would be dangerous to create more reason to leave Latin American countries at this point.
Nate, I wanted to go back to you on that earlier question of, what do you make of that reaction that we saw? I mean, I was, as Kelly said, it's disturbing. I was so just disgusted by the number of people. I wasn't surprised, but I was disgusted by the number of people who are not only defending Abrams, but also basically denying that the genocide happened. It's genocide denial.
Yeah, no, it's exactly that, and should be treated as such. I mean, with all of the, I guess, talk of anti-Semitism, it's like, this is literal, the equivalent of Holocaust denial, what we're doing here, by saying, oh, these were just mistakes that he did, as I think one of the foreign policy people at Center for American Progress put it. But oh yeah, he's great to work with.
Yeah, they said he had made mistakes in his career. Well, I mean, this is like 30 years ago, but, too. That's not, I mean, even 70 but years. You know,
in the Cold War mindset that these people still subscribe to, that when you're massacring peasants who could be construed as communists, you know, that's just maybe a mistake if they weren't technically communist. But it's not a moral question. That's not the issue. It's just more of like a managerial, like, do we kill the right people at the right time or not? But like, it doesn't really matter if we kill them or not, I guess, is the logic that they have there.
And of course, you know, again, to connect back to the present, basically applying the same policy with the war on terrorism, which is that if you are a male over a certain age in the wrong place at the wrong time, you are automatically considered a combatant who can be, you know, killed in a drone strike. Yeah. But yeah, so continue about the sort of the blob reaction to this. in D.C.
Yeah, and I mean, there's never been truth and reconciliation in our country, so it's not really, I guess, all that surprising that we just never really deal with any of this stuff, that the underlying logic of the Cold War has never really been, you know, upended for like the quote-unquote normal, you know, pundit and media class and all of that. So
I mean, it seems to be taking a lot of millennials basically getting into positions of a big enough platform to actually draw attention to this.
Yeah, and you know, even then, so you know, I guess Elliot Abrams got questioned, but he's still
he's still in government. Yeah, didn't slow down his new job. Yeah,
so yeah.
Yeah. Kelly, any concluding thoughts on any of this?
Well, I did think it was interesting to see that Elliot Abrams is part of the Holocaust Memorial Museum's Committee on Consciousness. And a number of survivors of atrocities which happened under Abrams' eye, as well as survivors of the Holocaust, have called for him to be removed from that committee. There is certainly an interest among sort of millennials and younger people, but it is also reassuring to see other members of our country and of the world call out Abrams for what he is and try to remove him from positions of powers or positions which might, in some people's eyes, absolve him from the crimes which he has committed.
I would encourage people to read up on this if you haven't heard about it, because again, it's okay if you haven't heard about it before, as long as you like look into it and get informed on it. It's not okay if you're going around saying that it didn't happen or whatever, just because you for some reason aren't aware of it. So Kelly, thanks for coming on here.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Bill.
And Nate, thanks for being here in studio.
Thanks, Bill.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on ArsenalForDemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.